This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, August 8, 2008. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado. A U.S. District Court decides on a groundbreaking Indian trust case first filed a dozen years ago. We'll go to Thailand and Berkeley to hear from survivors of the massacre that followed a pro-democracy uprising 20 years ago in Burma.
People do not want to stay under regime, under the military regime. They want to change, and international community help us for change.
And we'll hear from Beijing at the start of the Olympic Games there. All that and more after this news.
I'm Shannon Young with the headlines. Fighting in the Caucasus region of South Ossetia has triggered alarm that Russia and the Republic of Georgia may be headed for full-blown war. Russia sent troops, tanks, and aircraft into the separatist region this morning in response to a sudden buildup of Georgian military forces. The Georgian government accused Russia of bombing an airbase near the Georgian capital. Georgian troops have reportedly shelled South Ossetia's capital city. Media accounts of civilian casualties vary widely, ranging from 15 to as high as 1,000. The International Committee of the Red Cross has requested access to the region to help evacuate civilians. South Ossetia first declared independence from Georgia during the breakup of the Soviet Union, although the declaration went largely unrecognized. South Ossetian separatists have since compared their cause to that of Kosovo, a former Serbian province whose relatively recent declaration of independence was quickly recognized by most Western countries. In news from Iraq, Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr has announced an offer to disband his Mehdi Army militia in exchange for a timetable for the withdrawal of U.S. troops. The Bush administration has repeatedly rejected the notion of a set timetable, but recently announced the idea of a more ambiguously termed time horizon as part of an effort to finalize the language of a bilateral security agreement with Iraq. Negotiators are under pressure to shore up the terms of the deal in order to have it implemented before the UN mandate for foreign troop presence in Iraq expires at the end of the year. An indigenous and campesino leader in Guatemala has been assassinated just ahead of national actions to commemorate the International Day of Indigenous Peoples. Tim Russo has more from Guatemala.
Antonio Morales, a Guatemalan indigenous leader from the CUC, Committee of Campesino Unity, was attacked and hacked to death yesterday morning as he returned to his home in Colotenango, Guatemala. Morales was the national leader of the CUC, Sinuk, and Maya Washipke, three of Guatemala's most important indigenous organizations, which have actively opposed large-scale mining projects, hydroelectric projects, and the privatization of water. Such is the case in San Miguel Ixtahuacan, San Marcos, where Montana Exploring, a subsidiary of Canada's Goldcorp Inc., has spent thousands of dollars on trying to halt a community-led plebiscite that poses a threat in Montana's mining exploration and mineral extraction. 59 mayors of local villages and towns in the region have unified in opposition to Montana's mining, and the result has been increased military presence in the region to protect Montana's interests. The CUC, Sinuk, and Maya Washipke have denounced Morales' death as the most recent political intimidation, as they prepare massive protests in the 10 regions throughout Guatemala for today and Saturday in celebration of August 9th, International Day of Indigenous Peoples. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Tim Russo in Guatemala.
More legal troubles are on the horizon for Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick. Just shortly after posting bond to get out of jail, prosecutors brought new charges against the mayor. Kilpatrick now faces two charges of assault, stemming from an incident in which he allegedly shoved a police officer into an investigator. The Motor City mayor has refused to step down, despite the growing scandal. Independent presidential candidate Ralph Nader today released his proposed 12-point program to fight corporate crime. Catherine Jarmel has more from Washington, D.C.
The program would redirect funds for prosecution and policing away from nonviolent drug offenses toward a crackdown on corporate wrongdoing. Nader says the recent failures of Freddie Mae and Fannie Mae echo corporate corruption scandals seen during previous financial crises.
What we're seeing here is a combination of excessive power at the top of the corporation connected to unbridled greed, which connects to desire to engage in highly speculative behavior.
Nader says if corporate bosses didn't make so much money on stock options and short-term earnings, they would make smarter long-term market choices and listen to stockholders when making decisions. He also criticized the lack of control workers have over their benefits and retirement packages.
At a minimum, we need to give workers a voice on the pension board, not require workers to stuff their 401k plans with company stock, and give workers the right to control their 401k plans.
Nader's proposal calls for lower pay for executives, increases in shareholders' say, stronger investigation of corporate tax avoidance, dividend taxes, and the creation of an annual justice report on corporate crime. For Free Speech Radio News, this is Catherine Jarmel in Washington, D.C.
And those are the headlines. I'm Shannon Young.
A decision was handed down on a lawsuit filed 12 years ago by Native Americans for unpaid money owed by the U.S. government. The U.S. district judge said the U.S. must release $455 million of a trust. That's far less than the $47 billion the Native Americans requested. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
The trust was created in 1887 when the U.S. government attempted to provide individual Native Americans with land after the reservation system resulted in massive hunger. The Native Americans were to receive revenue from oil and gas and other extracted resources. The government controlled the trust, but has not kept track or managed the trust completely. There's been missing and destroyed documents and records. Only a small portion of the trust has been paid. More than 100 years later, in 1996, Eloise Coble, a member of the Blackfeet Tribe of Montana, filed a class action lawsuit on behalf of 500,000 beneficiaries of the uncollected money. They estimated they're owed $47 billion. U.S. District Judge James Robertson ruled that the Native Americans are owed money, but just a fraction of their request, $460 million. Hugh Vickery is spokesperson at the Interior Department, which controls the trust.
We're gratified that the court recognized the complexities and uncertainties involved in the case. And, the court examined the various models that were presented before it and determined that the government's model, the model we presented, was equitable and should be applied.
Keith Harper, attorney at Kilpatrick Stockton, represented the Native Americans.
What has been withheld, and therefore what is owed, is substantially more than the $500 million awarded.
The Epic court case involved the removal of the first judge, Royce Lamberth, who called the current and former Interior Secretary under President Clinton in contempt for reckless record-keeping and falsifying information to the court. In an earlier argument, Lamberth called the U.S. government, quote, racist and imperialistic. Harper says the removal of Judge Lamberth was unfortunate.
They removed a judge who was telling the truth.
The judge has not yet decided how the money would be distributed. Options still exist for disappointed Native Americans, including a damages claim or an appeal. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Leanne Caldwell.
A military tribunal at Guantanamo Bay convicted Osama bin Laden's former driver, Salim Ahmed Hamdan, of one count of providing material support for terrorism and sentenced him to 5.5 years. Hamdan was acquitted of the more serious conspiracy charge. This marks the first military tribunal at the Guantanamo Bay Detention Center, which opened in 2002. The verdict is seen as a major blow to the Bush administration, which argued for a stiffer sentence of 30 years to life. Ben Weisner works with the American Civil Liberties Union. He's one of the only civilians that attended the trial. He's been at Gitmo and watched the entire public proceeding.
Well, I have to say that these moments when the judge says, will the accused and his counsel stand up, and the Navy captain, who is the president of the jury, begins to read, are just so full of tension and emotion in that courtroom. I mean, remember, Hamdan has been traveling through the American legal system now for many, many years, including a trip to the Supreme Court. You know, just the day before, there had been really incredible drama when the jury rejected the most extreme charges that had been brought against Hamdan. When the head juror said 66 months, and everyone quickly did the calculation that it would be really 5 months or less because of the 61 months that Hamdan has already served in pretrial confinement. But really, I think there was shock in the courtroom. Charlie Swift, Hamdan's longtime lawyer, began to weep. Hamdan himself stood up and spontaneously addressed the jury. He began by apologizing to them for what he had done. He thanked them, he thanked the judge, he thanked everybody else. There were long embraces between the lawyers, and as Hamdan walked out of the courtroom, he pumped his arms in the air and said in English, "Bye-bye, everybody." It was the first English that we had heard out loud from Hamdan.
Wisner adds that the judge in the case is confused about what may happen to Hamdan once he serves his sentence at Guantanamo.
One of the most amazing moments yesterday occurred when the judge was trying to explain to Hamdan what would happen to him in 4 months. And he looked up and said, "I don't know what happens to you in 4.5 months. That's when you will finish your sentence as a post-trial detainee, and then it's in someone else's hands what happens to you." The prosecutor said the same thing. They said, "We don't know what's going to happen to him after he serves his sentence here." And I think the administration has made quite clear that they have no intention of releasing Hamdan, even though the jury said that it's almost time for him to go home. And any system in which the prosecutor and the judge cannot even tell the accused what will happen to him after his punishment is over is not one that can be defended. It's one that has to be scrapped.
According to the military tribunal's sentence, Hamdan should be released in 4 months, although the Pentagon has already stated that they could name him a so-called enemy combatant and he could be held indefinitely. You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. 20 years ago today, the military dictatorship, which continues to rule Burma, brutally crushed a pro-democracy uprising known as 8888, killing an estimated 3,000 people in just 6 weeks. Leaders of that 1988 student-led uprising have been imprisoned since last summer's widespread civic disturbances, along with more than 1,000 other long-term political prisoners, including the opposition's National League for Democracy leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, the Nobel Peace Laureate, who remains under house arrest on the orders of leader General Tang Shui. On this anniversary of the Burmese uprising, FSRN will travel to Thailand, where the largest number of Burmese refugees are located, and hear from survivors of the massacre. Then we'll go to Berkeley, California, home to many Burmese who also fled the violence. First from Bangkok, Claudia Craig reports.
In the 1988 uprisings, Burmese exile and activist Aung Zaw was detained by the military regime and severely tortured during interrogation in Rangoon's notorious Insein prison. Today, Aung Zaw does not like to focus on his 8888 experience, but instead works full-time to improve human rights in Burma. On the opening day of the Beijing Olympics, also coinciding with this anniversary, he says current human rights activism and its message to China is key to any democratic solution for Burma.
I think it will send a very strong signal to China and Burma's neighbor, not just to General Tan Shui, who continue to defend the military junta in Burma. The message to China is quite clear that if they can neutralize, quarantine China, and Burma will also see a change.
Dr. Tein L. Win is also a former political prisoner and once a close associate of Aung San Suu Kyi, leader of the opposition party, the National League for Democracy. He now runs a migrant center in Chiang Mai, northern Thailand, where he educates and resettles children, adults, and Burmese who come to him in Thailand. Speaking to FSRN, Dr. Tein L. Win, like most Burmese who have suffered at the hands of the junta, understates the true horrors of his experience and states his fears for those who continue to try and escape repression.
I have been 2 years imprisonment before I left Burma in Rangoon. My political participation in the democratic movement, this is the judge. Yes, many difficulties, across the border, many difficulties. Some people, they lost their life and drowned in water and shot dead. My mother is there, yeah. She wants me to go back home. She understands I cannot go home.
The current regime designates him as a member of a terrorist group which has been constantly committing terrorist acts to endanger lives and properties of innocent people. But Dr. Tein Nguyen continues to speak out and says the military regime in Burma must come to an end soon.
People do not want to stay under regime, under the military regime. They want to change. And international community helped us for change. But change a peaceful means through dialogue. and his power does not come from the people and respect and belief, and the regime can fall down very soon, I understand, because people are suffer and people, and he wants to change country as a democratic nation. Aung San Suu Kyi is a hope, and I'm optimistic that Burma can change soon.
Some refugees say the commemorative events from Dublin to Bangkok to Berkeley and wherever Burmese exiles gather gives them some hope of return one day soon. In Bangkok, I'm Claudia Cragg for Free Speech Radio News.
Nearly 100 activists gathered at Berkeley City Hall this morning to observe the 8888 anniversary of the uprising in Burma and to raise the Burmese flag. Many political exiles in the United States continue to struggle against the military junta in Burma, Africa Jones reports.
Ashton Kavita is a Buddhist monk who led protests in Burma last year. After the military junta began a crackdown on the protests, he fled the country. Speaking in Berkeley on this 20th anniversary of the uprising, he says the people of Burma inspired the protest.
Buddhist monks in Burma, they are relying on the people, because many poor people in our country, so we all decide what to have to do for the people. So we all monetize to the demonstration, and peaceful demonstration in Burma.
Activists in the United States have been trying to pressure China to stop the military junta, which rules Burma. Nyet Tan is president of the Burmese American Democratic Alliance and was a student demonstrator 20 years ago. He's been holding protests in front of the Chinese consulate in San Francisco throughout the year.
We also note today is the opening day of the Beijing Olympic. We are not against people of China. We are not against the Olympic, but we are totally against the Chinese regime policy in supporting this brutal dictatorship in Burma. Because of China, economic, military, and diplomatic support, the regime is stronger and people are weaker and suffering more.
China, along with Russia and South Africa, opposed UN-sponsored sanctions against Burma. Activists have also targeted Chevron, headquartered in San Ramon, California, for its trade with the junta. Nyet Tan.
Chevron Corporation is one of the another big reason, main reason why this region is sustained in Burma. Chevron Corporation actually channeled the Burmese gas from the Gulf of Burma into Thailand and bring in hundreds of millions of dollars to this regime that is used in purchasing arms from China. So while people are living in darkness and eating very little or no food, their gas are being taken out with the help of the Chevron, and the arms are being supplied to this regime.
Activists hope to continue to pressure Burma and its supporters to improve human rights within the country. Berkeley has declared August 8th Burma Day and says it will allow the raising of the Burmese flag at City Hall on August 8th until Burma is free. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Africa Jones.
You're listening to Free Speech Radio News. FSRN has brought you uncensored news from the U.S. and around the world every day for more than 7 years. We're proud of our history of challenging old models of media access and control by highlighting the voices of marginalized communities most affected by social and economic policy changes. Now, a large funding cut and economic hard times jeopardize our ability to continue producing a daily newscast. You can visit us online at fsrn.org to find out more about how you can help keep us on the air. That's fsrn.org.
Beijing offers everything from state-of-the-art stadiums to a world-class performance at the opening ceremony. Everything except free speech for athletes. There are political issues under censorship by the government, particularly the Tiananmen Square massacre in 1989, the religious group Falun Gong, and human rights in Tibet, and pressures put on athletes by corporate sponsors and even the International Olympic Committee. Over half of the revenue for the IOC comes from broadcasting rights. Sophie Richardson is the advocacy director of the Asia Division at Human Rights Watch.
I know there are at least some athletes out there who have wanted to speak their mind about issues, human rights issues that are salient in the upcoming games. but are clearly under pressure from their management companies, from their National Olympic committees, possibly even from their teammates, about not doing so.
Joey Cheek is a gold medalist in speed skating. At 27, he's retired from the sport.
At least I hear through the grapevine through athletes that are friends and still competing that are getting ready for these games. I think that there's just enormous pressure on athletes to not say anything at all. But I think that there's a way they can still use their voice, they can still speak about the issues they believe are important. And more than that, I think they're absolutely entitled to this.
After winning at the 2006 Winter Games in Turin, Italy, Cheeks donated $40,000 to refugee children fled from conflict in Darfur. But he didn't stop there and co-founded advocacy group Team Darfur, raising more than $1 million. For this year's Olympics, 72 athletes on the U.S. Olympic team publicly listed their name with the Team Darfur campaign. That didn't sit well with Chinese officials, who canceled Cheeks' visa the day before he planned to fly out.
And as soon as I made that transition from just trying to help kids to saying, hey, maybe these governments need to do something to protect them, then it became, you know, people started saying, oh, now it's politics. It became more of an issue.
Also speaking on Darfur, U.S. Olympic men's basketball player Kobe Bryant. He made a public service announcement to raise awareness.
What do you stand for?
Bryant's teammate LeBron James also said that at one point, the U.S. Olympic men's basketball team could bring visibility to Darfur at the Olympic Games. But when pressed later, James shied away from the issue, saying that they would focus their energy on winning. Bryant and James both have lucrative contracts with Nike, including Olympic merchandise such as team jerseys and sneakers. Lynn Colley is a professor of sports marketing at the University of Oregon.
Well, typically the contracts will have some kind of moral clause and some kind of constraint restricting what people can do. So the athlete can't do anything or necessarily say anything if it's going to be viewed as offensive and controversial. And sometimes it may be difficult to know exactly where that line is.
Kobe Bryant is a household name among young men in Beijing. Marketing by Nike and NBA China may be part of the reason why they're so popular here. NBA China estimates there are 300 million basketball fans in China, the same population as the United States. 21-year-old Zhang Yi plays basketball regularly at an outdoor court in Beijing. He estimates he has dozens of Nike's Kobe Bryant merchandise.
We think of them less highly if they say something anti-China. I think they'll be careful of what they say because they are representing their own country and Nike.
16-year-old Fu Zihao says he buys NBA merchandise based on his basketball influences. His expression becomes serious over the possibility of any criticism of China by U.S. players.
If some basketball players talk like that, it's because they don't understand China. That's why they would talk like that. I hope when they come to Beijing for the Olympics, they get to know China.
IOC rules prohibit any kind of demonstration, political, religious, or racial, at any Olympic site. And this week, IOC President Jacques Rogge said in the British paper The Daily Telegraph that athletes would face censure if they used Olympic venues to express political opinion. He said it would be considered political demonstration if an athlete staying at the Olympic Village put up a Free Tibet poster in their room. However, athletes can express their views outside the Olympic venues, including at press conferences. Even bracelets representing a cause would fall under the category of political propaganda. Team Darfur bracelets, actually sweatbands, have three colors represented on the flag of Sudan. Again, Joey Cheek.
All the way up to the games, we hope that they'll wear them and talk about the issue. We hope that they'll talk about the issue in Beijing, but we ask them not to wear the bracelets because it's, you know, it's in violation of the IOC rules. And we've got a number of Olympians and former Olympians as part of this organization, and so we respect those rules.
Sophie Richardson says that Human Rights Watch has repeatedly asked the International Olympic Committee to clarify precisely what it deems or considers political speech.
Our concern is the IOC or National Olympic Committees are going to come under tremendous pressure, either from the Chinese government or from the Chinese Olympic Committee, if athletes do wear their Free Tibet t-shirts or their Darfur bracelets or, you know, make some sort of statement in an Olympic venue.
She says the IOC seems to have bowed down to China's idea of free speech rather than upholding the international standard. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Adelaide Chen in Beijing.
And as the 2008 Olympic Games begin in Beijing, supporters of Tibetan independence continue to protest China's control of the region. After yesterday's report by FSRN correspondent Bismila Gilani on Tibetan refugees protesting across India, home of the Tibetan government in exile, today police in nearby Nepal arrested more than 1,000 people protesting at the Chinese embassy in Kathmandu. Those arrested include Buddhist monks and nuns. At least 20,000 Tibetan refugees live in Nepal, but the government there supports Chinese control of Tibet and ceased giving refugee status to Tibetans about 20 years ago. Human rights groups say China has pressured Nepal to crack down on protesters. Earlier this week in China, police arrested and deported activists who hung Free Tibet banners near a stadium. Besides breaking records and shiny medals, the 1968 Olympic Games in Mexico City may best be remembered for the Black Power salute. Tommy Smith and John Carlos, who both won medals in a 200-meter race at the 1968 Games, literally took a stand as they collected their medals on the stage. As the U.S. national anthem played, Smith and Carlos, who approached the stage shoeless, bowed their heads. In this historic interview, preserved by the Pacifica Radio Archives, Olympic medalist John Carlos talks about the 1968 action with sports sociologist Jonathan Brower.
Basically, I would say we demonstrated that we were two black individuals that won the gold medals, and first of all, to let them know, you know, anytime a fellow by the name of Mark Spitz would win a medal, it's known Mark Spitz won, bigger praise, everything, you know, Peggy Flemings. And we just wanted to let black people throughout the world know, you know, that we ran representing them. Because as far as the national anthem is concerned, it's like an insurance policy, supposedly. You know, like I would cover it because I'm, you know, subject to be drafted, or my kids are subject to be drafted and go fight and represent America. And all the words in the national anthem didn't cover black people or minority people. And I didn't feel that I should go up to me and stand up at attention and applaud something I disagree with totally. You know, I'd be being hypocritical to myself. So we just went up there to let them know that we were two black individuals that won the gold medals. We're trying to tell black people and minority people that they're going to have to become more united to stand against the struggles that they have in front of them, and to let them know that we were, you know, very poor. You know, that was why we didn't wear any shoes and so forth out there.
And that was Olympic medalist John Carlos speaking in a historic interview preserved by the Pacifica Radio Archives. John Carlos and his fellow Olympian Tommy Smith were booed on stage by the crowd because of their action. Smith would later respond, "If I win, I am American. I'm not black American. But if I did something bad, then they would say, I'm a Negro. We are black and we are proud of being black. Black America will understand what we did tonight." You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Pacifica Station KPFK in LA, I'm Aura Bogado.